The way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of ditto.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is. And that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, the countdown for disclosure. So, today I'm back. I have a signal. This is great. I very much enjoyed reading Ashtar's words to you in the last 2 days. It was a nice breakaway. And also, it gives us a perspective of a picture of the whole, how the Galactic Federation is working with us here on Earth to help us come through this very tense time. So today what I'd like to do is go back reviewing the witnesses that will be at the citizens' hearing for disclosure between April 29th and May 3rd in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. And I'm going to give you a presentation today that's longer than the average presentation because, frankly, I don't want to break it down. The information's too comprehensive and too good not to share the whole thing, so that's what I'd like to do. Also, I want to read to you something that I wrote last night about disclosure and Nisara. And also I want to share something from the Keshi Foundation. So we're going to go a little bit over and we're going to skip the meditation at the end today, but we'll be back on track with everything tomorrow. An important part of disclosure is we're interested in a time when we can welcome our galactic family back to Earth. And they absolutely will not come until we have world peace. They won't come to a planet that has warring nations. And that's why the Keshi information is so important. So I'm going to start with that. This is written by nuclear engineer M.T. Keshi of Iran. Signing of the World Peace Treaty and World Peace Conference in the name of the glory of God. From the beginning of time, man's desire has been to have plenty to eat and a safe place to shelter, to create a tranquil environment where he can live with peace of mind, in this process develop his culture, and add to his knowledge of his environment, of the universe, and of creation. Now man's intelligence has reached a new level in understanding the true knowledge of the universe through the development of magnetic and gravitational systems and technologies with which he can replicate and control matters and environments the same as they are in the universe. These symbols can provide him with food. These systems can provide him with food, shelter, and everlasting energy anywhere in the universe, and give him the opportunity for the first time to travel the spans of the universe in an environment like the one he is familiar with on his planet and in his daily life. By using these new systems, man will be able to cross his planet in minutes, and this makes the borders which he has made for himself over the centuries a thing of the past, irrelevant and obsolete. Now that man is preparing to travel in space, just as he travels around his planet, and is getting ready to join the universal community and to venture into the spans of the universe as the other creations of God do, he needs to find peace in his own home first. To achieve this last goal, and for man to find peace on his own planet, there is a need for rapid and total agreement by all the citizens, nations, creeds, and religions on this planet to come together in one move, because trying to make peace in stages will never succeed. To achieve world peace, we call upon all the leaders of the world to gather this year in one location to attend a world peace conference and to establish a world peace treaty by signing a simple act of acceptance of worldwide peace. The one and only sentence of the world peace treaty to be signed by the leaders of nations and religions and to be sworn to by every nation across the earth on the same day is simple and reads as follows. We, as citizens of the earth, from this moment on, accept to lay down all tools of aggression and war. We shall never think about getting involved in or incite war or develop or use any tools of war on this planet or in space. And to this, we all agree and swear with our nation, territory, council, religion, city, town, body, and soul. With this letter, we call upon the leaders of Earth to gather at an appointed time and place as representatives of the planet's different religions, of the planet's different regions, not only its countries, to sign this treaty on behalf of their parts of Earth. From this point on, nationhood will cease to exist, and mankind as one race and nation will become Earth's only true citizens. As citizens of this planet, we appoint the time of signing of the World Peace Treaty by our leaders to be noon on 21 March 2013. This day being the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere and a good day to start afresh in peace and tranquility on this planet. Following the signing of the World Peace Treaty by the leaders of the world on 21 March 2013, then on 21 April 2013, the anniversary of the first International Ambassadorial Peace Conference on 21 April 12, which set the scene for this event, we invite all citizens of the world at the same time around the world to swear to the same peace treaty as individuals in cooperation as their leaders did the month before. From this day on, man shall not make any tools of war or make any plans of aggression against other lands or cause any man's death. From this day, the human race will lay down the tools of war, which have caused so much misery over thousands of years, and all men shall work towards one target of enabling all of humanity to enjoy the fruits of peace. We call upon world citizens to do what you did in the last year by encouraging your governments to attend the ambassadorial conferences at our center and accept the spaceship technology USB key. We ask you to do the same again and call all embassies around the world and send a copy of the World Peace Treaty to world leaders, all embassies and individuals around the world, and to post the World Peace Treaty document and invitation on every forum and webpage and every presidential palace and king's palace wall across the world so that this day shall become World Peace Treaty Day. and your leaders will be compelled to attend and sign the World Peace Treaty Act and carry out its implications with your support. In return, the Keshe Foundation will release all its technologies, including plans and working units and technology for space, energy, health, and food, to all mankind in one move and in one go on that day. With this, we guarantee you to make available an equal share of science, wealth, health, care, food, energy, and freedom of space to every nation and person on this planet. We thank you for your support, and from now on, world peace is in your hands and not in the hands of your leaders. With loving greetings, Maran Tavakoli Keshe, world citizen and founder of the Keshe Foundation. So everybody, this is a gift from the Galactic Federation. This isn't this one man doing this. This is coming from Ashtar. Now I'd like to move into what I had written. It's called Disclosure, Announcements, and Nisara, the Big Picture, and this is part three. This is posted at galacticroundtable.org, and there are links to this article, parts one and parts two, if you are behind the times in reading this and you're interested in looking at it. On April 15th, 2010, President Obama gave a speech at the Kennedy Space Center at NASA. He disclosed a vital piece of the puzzle for the secret space program, but no one noticed. He said, "That's the story of NASA, NASA, and it's a story that started a little more than half a century ago, far from the space coast, in a remote and desolate region of what is now called Kazakhstan, because it was from there that the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, which was little more than a few pieces of metal with a transmitter and a battery strapped to the top of a missile. But the world was stunned. Americans were dumbfounded. The Soviets, it was perceived, had taken the lead in a race for which we were not yet fully prepared. The secret space program effectively began on July 7, 1947, when they changed the story of the Zeta Reticulan ship being run off course when we messed with the radar waves, which made their instrumentation veer off course and crash their craft. Major Jesse Marcel Sr. said the debris they picked up was metal no thicker than the foil from a cigarette packet. But if you put a sledgehammer to it, it did not bend. He was in charge then in the United States and the Pacific for the Army of all air-terrain radar mapping systems, and he said that the metal was not of this world. When Sputnik was launched, members of the United States military and intelligence and their counterparts in the Soviet Union, who were both under contract with the negative extraterrestrials at the time, fabricated a cover story together. How else were they going to siphon money off their national budgets undetected for the next 65 years? Sometimes they worked together, and do to this day, on the multiple international space stations going out to deep space, bringing back payloads that would blow your mind. Back in 1960, when Sputnik circled the Earth, Americans were dumbfounded. An artificial cold relationship was crafted by the governments of the United States and Russia, who were allies in World War II. They felt if they threw together a few pieces of metal with a battery strapped to the top of a missile and a transmitter to show us its route while in flight, it would effectively cause a competition between the two countries. It worked. It has worked for 65 years. How much longer will you be lied to? How much longer will you allow money to be spent on something you do not know a thing about? In 1961, President Kennedy, made his famous speech asking for Americans to prepare to travel to the moon. President Obama said at NASA in 2010, the Soviets, it was perceived, had taken the lead in a race for which we were not yet fully prepared. In 1961, the United States National Security Agency, NSA, which had been born out of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, landed on the moon with NSA astronauts. President Kennedy was well aware of this. When he decided to whistleblow, then he did not make it. NASA was a cover story. NASA was a civilian agency. NSA was under the Department of Defense, DOD. NASA received its funding, and that money was put into technologies put into place by reverse engineers and the private contractors working for DOD. Reverse engineers took the spacecrafts shot down by the U.S. military and reverse engineered anti-gravity devices and more. Lockheed Martin is one example where a company builds bombs to launder money from war into the secret space program, while at Skunk Works, a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin, is building secret technologies for the secret space program and making hand over fist on both ends. Do you think all of these private contractors like Boeing want you to have full galactic disclosure and end their honeypot? Zero Point Energy, which the Keshe Foundation is equipped to release to the world, would end all war. These military, intelligence, government, and private contractors would have all their excessive income go away, as well as likely see jail sentences for breaking their oaths of office, and more. Since 1961, NSA has been running flights to the moon and Mars, sometimes weekly. Large payloads were taken to the moon from the space elevators in Diego Garcia and Sri Lanka. You can easily see them from Google Earth. Take a look. This is how they built the structures on the moon and Mars. The New York Times wrote three articles on the National Space Council between 1989 and 1991 about how ex-NASA chief Richard Truly was going to blow the whistle on the Bush administration about the billion-dollar budget being spent on the moon and Mars. Bush Sr. fired him and closed the National Space Council and sealed the records. How much longer will you allow money to be spent on something you do not know a thing about? Why do you think the United States mints all the extra dollars they need to pay off the private contractors and others working for the secret space program? The disclosure and advocacy movement of exopolitics has been holding meetings for years, exposing these and other truths, but no one is listening. On May 9, 2001, Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project held a meeting at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where many witnesses who had been to the biggest events in UFO history came forward and explained to the world about the ongoing truth embargo. Less than 2 months later, President George W. Bush left for Texas, where he spent 91 days at his ranch instead of in the White House. George Bush Sr. and Dick Cheney, with Donald Rumsfeld and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Richard Myers, with several others, planned 9/11. They worked all summer, and on the morning when Alan Greenspan was at the World Trade Center, the financial headquarters of the United States, to publicly begin to announce provisions of Nasara law, Dick Cheney, working from 50 stories below the White House with NSA operatives, worked the joystick flying the missiles into the towers and the Pentagon. It was so much worse than duping people with the first missile called Sputnik. It set Nasara law enactment back 11 years and counting. Do you think you can connect the dots between disclosure, announcements, and Nasara? They say hindsight is 2020 vision. How much longer are you going to allow money to be spent on something you know nothing about? You wonder why Congress refuses to make things better. On April 29th to May 3rd, 2013, there will be a citizen hearing held for the first time in 45 years concerning extraterrestrials at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House and 12 blocks from the Capitol. Some 40 or 50 witnesses will give testimony to former Congress members, and it will be filmed for a documentary called The Truth Embargo. This is being produced by the executive director of Paradigm Research Group, Stephen Bassett. There will be a live stream available for a nominal fee all week. It is important that together we witness the disclosure of the secret space program from the whistleblowers, witnesses, and researchers who have dedicated their lives to telling the truth. To arrange live streaming of the event, visit citizenhearing.org. Archives of the event will be free to all with no suppression of the information. Later, the Truth Embargo documentary will be available in theaters around the nation. As Earth citizens, it is our responsibility that we participate in action politics and ask our elected officials to come clean. President Obama just may be prepared to do this. It is possible he has been preparing for lifetimes to do just this. President Obama will be the disclosure president. This will pave the way for announcements and the enactment of Nasara law. First, we the people must ask him to. You may help by simply signing a petition. Can you spare 2 or 3 minutes to sign a petition? If you are over 13 years old and a citizen of Earth, in any country, you are eligible to sign. We need 100,000 signatures. Can I count on you to spread the word in social media? There are millions of people all over the world who have been contactees and or abductees, and they know for certain that extraterrestrials are real. Millions. Can we get 100,000 signatures? Please sign the petition at wh.gov/HQQE. Until Earth citizens acknowledge between themselves and their elected officials that there have been engagement between ET and their governments, they will not decloak and land on Earth. Why would they? There are superficial issues which relate to NASA flights and deeper questions which deal with NSA flights, which were occurring 8 years before the first NASA astronauts did arrive on the moon. NSA craft and ET crafts were parked on the moon when NASA arrived. So there were both fake and real flights. Only the NSA flights, with the help of negative ETs, were allowed to continue. NASA was thrown off the moon by both negative ETs and NSA and told not to come back. That is why NASA never went back to the moon. The covert operations within the moon structures were not to benefit we the people, but only a few haughty souls who today do not mind watching you starve and lose your homes. The bankers and the mortgage underwriters. Enter Nasara Law. The secret space program uses an academy across the highway inside a mountain from the Air Force Academy in Colorado. The real NSA astronauts fly the ultra-top-secret TR-3B, Aurora, and other anti-gravity-equipped craft, like the Shark helicopter, designed by reverse engineers. Today, there is not one International Space Station, ISS. There are many. The civilian agency, NASA, uses 2 power units on the ISS. The typical rocket thrusters of the typical launch. Secretly, they have another puzzle to display, another booster, the second booster that cuts in far above prying eyes. They're using propulsion technology that effectively transforms a megaton platform into one weighing only a few pounds and sends them on to many strange places far from their supposed objectives. This is how they serve as many secret space platforms. We have many of these so-called ISS platforms. They can launch one of these and get to where they can rendezvous with their target days ahead of conventional craft and in silence. That's a pretty closely kept secret. How much longer are you going to allow money to be spent on something you know nothing about? On the ISS, off-planet scientists and astronauts work together with Earth astronauts on joint missions. A few of the other major players have been involved from the beginning, include the Pleiadians, Arcturians, Antares, Andromedans, Procyon, Lyra Vega, Virgo, Orion constellations with planets which reach across quite a polarity spectrum, Draco's, Ursa Major Bear, Ursa Minor, Leo, Sag, Zeti, inner planets of Venus, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, the outer planets of Uranus, Mercury, Pluto, Neptune, Nibiru, and 100 million billion galaxies, and the great central sun. This is a planetary ascension that involves all of these and many more for which we do not remember or know the names. Some of you have vague memories of coming from these places. President Obama has the technology to link through video from Camp David to these missions in space, communicating with these astronauts. Twin brothers, and both of them commanders of the ISS, Mark and Scott Kelly, helped Gabrielle Giffords, who was on the House of Representatives Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, recover from a gunshot wound to the brain in a black ops attempt to take her life. Gabby is married to Mark Kelly, and he is now retired from the space program. He had logged more miles to the ISS from the space shuttle than any other before he retired. Actually, it was a tie, but that was too much to write into the piece. It was a tie with another guy. It is time to end the truth embargo. In the post-Nassara world, transportation, which is now is all polluting and petroleum-based, will go away. Zero-point devices and energies will be non-polluting, inexpensive, and complementary to our development. Most factories and power plants and highways will no longer be appropriate. We will be using anti-gravity lifting devices of many types that require no such support systems. Since every particle of matter and spirit is upgrading, even our present homes will upgrade with us until we are ready and desiring to move to the crystal cities and restore the old areas to pristine natural areas. Tabletop 3D copiers, replicators, and organic gardens with new seeds and new technologies are the two most important aspects of our new living arrangements. We will want everything in our homes and everything we eat and wear to be non-toxic to us and others. I can tell you that the ship's replicators can make anything you can imagine exactly the way you most desire it to look and taste, and yet be completely healthy and supportive of our new crystalline structures. New ways to communicate in many modes will replace our current commercial systems. I will be at the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure April 29th to May 3rd because I feel it is one of the most important events we will ever witness in our lifetimes. I invite you. I implore you. I beseech you to be there too, asking for the change which you desire to see, either live or live stream. We will do this together, and we will do this with love. Please sign the petition right now. Please share it so we obtain quickly the 100,000 signatures it deserves. Okay, that's the piece that I wrote last night. I want to read a little bit of a note that I put at the bottom of this piece. I guess I'm asking for help. Also in April, I have to travel 3 times to bring the light codes in. I will be attending a spiritual retreat with Sri Swami Purna to ground the energies before disclosure. I have posted about it in events at galacticroundtable.org that will take place April 12th to 15th. Next, I will be attending the Sirius movie premiere in L.A. on April 22nd. A week later, I will fly to the citizen hearing on April 29th, and I will be there all week. In all cases, my flights and registrations are paid for as donations from friends. I still have expenses for the pilgrimage. I really could use your help to see me through April. Please donate if you can. Any small amount will help. It is my duty to carry my energy to these places to see disclosure through. It is my mission. I still need help with transfers once I land, taxis, trains. I need parking fees at the airport 3 times or transport there, which is a 2-hour one direction to get there. I will need an occasional meal. I do not at the moment have money for these things. You may donate as you feel inspired to lift some of this burden from my shoulders. If you would like to mail me a check, please send me an email. The places to contribute are on galacticroundtable.org, and I appreciate your help. So today something exciting happened. The live streaming opened up for purchase. And so if you go to citizenshearing.org, you can buy 1 week of live streaming and have it queued up in your email. All you're going to have to do is click on it when the Citizens Hearing starts, and you're going to see the whole thing. And I'm very happy to tell you that this is available in English, in Spanish, in Arabic, in Japanese, and in Hindi. And then the archives will also be available in Chinese. I'm so excited about this. So I went through the process so I could tell you what happens. Go to citizenshearing.org and go to the tab on top that choose live stream. And in my case, I picked English. And when you go there, there's a button. This is what it says. Purchase access here to watch the entire Citizens Hearing on Disclosure live in English. Click to purchase your English language live streaming pass to the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure for $3.80. This pass will be good from 8:45 a.m. to 6:45 p.m. Eastern Time for all 5 days of the hearing, April 29th to May 3rd. The pass also includes lectures presented by hearing witnesses each evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Leading up to the hearing, you will have free access to trailers and other videos as they become available. You may also purchase access to the archive of the live stream for $3.80, which will be posted here on May 5th and accessible through the end of May. So I went to... I went and I clicked on the button to purchase it. And what it did was it took me right into PayPal. And so when you get to that page, if you don't have a PayPal account, you can sign up, but you don't have to use PayPal. You can use a credit card or a check. So it took me right to PayPal. It charged me $3.80 and I got an automatic email into my email account that was my PayPal email. And in there is a link that I can go into my email and see the link and click on it all week, and it'll take me right into the live streaming. So do that today. Get ready to watch this. It's $3.80 for all week. And if you haven't yet already, I hope you'll go to galacticroundtable.org and click on the picture of the We the People petition and sign it. When we have 150 signatures, then it will go live and everyone in the world will be able to see it on that website, and it will bring the attention of the media to the cause. And before I started talking this morning. We had 148 signatures, and now we have 150, so we've gone live. And I'm looking for volunteers who have connections to thousands of people on their blogs to volunteer and push this petition and get us up to 150,000, because we have until April 22nd, the day of the Sirius premiere, to do that, and I know that we can. So I'm going to move on now. I would like to introduce to you Richard Dolan. He's an expert since the early 1970s. He's been studying the secret space program. And if I went through the list of witnesses and I had to pick a favorite, I'd be lying if I didn't say he's probably my favorite. But that's only because I'm obsessed with the topic and I find his work to be brilliant. So I had a chance to meet Richard Dolan just for a few brief minutes. And I just wanted to share that he's a really nice guy besides. And, you know, he's what everybody would call just a regular guy. I got to talk to him for a few brief minutes, and then I think I was smiling for the next 2 days. Really a great guy. Richard is very analytical in his thinking. His work is, he's an avid reader and writer. His website is keyholepublishing.com, and you can see the many things he's written there. If you go to YouTube and put in Richard Dolan, you're going to find some of the best information on exopolitics you've ever seen anywhere, and you'll be transfixed. Richard speaks very down to earth, but also like a professor. And I know we're running long, but I'm going to share the whole video because he fills in the blanks that I don't know and brings out information that others are not speaking about. So it wouldn't be fair, really, to cut down this video. For me, he brings the spotlight to the most important aspects of this whole, you know, large, vast array of information. It's not the most important, but it's right up there. There's too many parts of the story, like the underground bases holding ETs and keeping them alive, and all the other things, the technologies that have been hidden from us and how we've worked with the negative extraterrestrials to make technologies, and all of those things combined with the Roswell issue. And it's such a big issue. But the secret space program, nobody tells it like Richard. So we have to listen to all of this. I know you will enjoy it. Here we go. I'm starting it about 8 minutes in. And this is his talk. This is Exopolitics Great Britain Lectures. And this is when he was at Leeds in the UK. Thank you.
Which you've heard a little bit about today. And the whole issue of how and what and whether there's a UFO disclosure and what all that means. And I'm glad that I'm able to follow on Ian Crane's very, very interesting lecture, because I think some of the issues I deal with are approaching the topic maybe in a different way, maybe in a compatible way. So you'll get to see how that all works out. Explain to you why I think that's the case. There's a number of themes that I want to go into today. So that any kind of disclosure or openness or breaking out of the secret on this topic is going to have to deal with these various issues. First, it's going to have to deal with the very confrontational relationship that we have had with them, whoever them happen to be. And I'll explain that a little more. Second will be, because once the disclosure comes out, there'll have to be some kind of analysis of the vast illegal structure of secrecy as it has evolved over six or more decades to hide this. And after all, if the President of the United States were to say, well, it's come to my attention that, you know, in fact, the UFO phenomenon appears to be real, and some of them are not us. You know, he would like to say, well, now I'm going on vacation for a few months, see ya, but that really won't be possible. There'll be follow-up issues, I'm sure. And so one of them is going to be, well, how have you kept the secret? And that's going to get into some very, very nasty little issues that will be difficult, I think, to avoid. The third issue is that disclosure or the end of the secrecy will involve will be an analysis and an understanding at some point of what the secret program really is about. You know, what are they doing with all this secrecy? Are they building flying saucers, for example, and other things? The fourth thing, then you're going to have to ask, well, who are these other beings? What is that all about? Why are they interested in us, if they are? Yes, they certainly are, I think. And then I think what will happen is any kind of outing of this issue is going to present a risk and a great challenge. Think back to something, you know, one generation ago when Mikhail Gorbachev became head of the Soviet Communist Party in 1985. And it seemed great. Perestroika, glasnost, restructuring opens. Wow. Anyone who is studying this at the time, and I think most of us were just blown away by this. But what happened? Well, 6 years later, there was no more Soviet Union. In other words, I think the process of reform spiraled out of his control, and I think that's child's play compared with what would likely happen in the event of true openness on this particular issue. Now, all of those, you know, would make you think, well, this is just such a difficult issue, and it's never going to, there's no incentive for the power elite to broach it. That's true, but it's going to happen anyway. I believe it's inevitable, and I hope to explain why I think that's the case. When I do any presentation anywhere, I never, ever, ever want to assume that everyone is on my page. There are always people who say, you know, well, I think a lot of this UFO stuff is kind of not persuasive. What is your case? Why do you think there's something valid to it? That's perfectly fair. You should always ask that question. In my own opinion, I think that the UFO phenomenon is very, very well documented. That doesn't mean it proves that it's an alien phenomenon, but it's certainly exceedingly well documented that we have something serious going on. This is my vote for maybe a top 15 or so documents that are all public domain. You can find them yourself, that most of these are United States military and intelligence community documents dealing with really the impossible being here. So in other words, a lot of airspace violation documents, 1950 Hanford Atomic Energy Commission, just as one example, where they describe the Atomic Energy Commission's facility in Hanford, Washington State, was a big deal. And there is a situation where numerous round spherical objects were seen. The military brought out anti-aircraft battalions, fighter interceptors, alerted a whole range of agencies, and were unable to, at least in the one memo that we have, they were obviously concerned. They didn't know what these things were. That's one example. There's another, the 1952 CIA memo. This is a memo from the chief of scientific intelligence to the director of the CIA, describing objects of unknown origin at altitudes and speeds, over sensitive installations of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known aircraft, things like this. You know, keeping in mind these are bureaucratic memos where they're not just going to come out and say, boss, I think we're being invaded, but they might as well. Some of these, the language in some of these is really, really very grave. Earlier today, a mention was made of the famous Malmstrom Air Force Base case in which a glowing red object was seen by above ground personnel hovering over an area where there were 10 or 12 Minuteman missiles below ground, which all went offline, bing, 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 one after the other. They were studied by Boeing, which was in charge of them. Boeing had absolutely no explanation as to how those could have gone offline as they did. They were offline for an entire day. And on and on. The famous Halt memo dealing with the Rendlesham case has certain key factual errors in it, but it's a fascinating and important memo anyway, and it does confirm that some pretty strange stuff happened at a major base here in Britain. And as a matter of fact, we now know, we have absolute clarity, as Gary Heseltine mentioned during one of the brief chat here, Colonel Halt has now formally acknowledged that the beams coming down from this object, actually, as Halt had said privately some years before, adversely affected the ordnance. That is, in other words, the nuclear weapons that were being stored there without knowledge of the public. Okay, so what's all that about? Well, you can argue over who's behind the UFO phenomenon, but even if you just take these 15 documents, I really don't think you can have any reasonable mind can argue that there isn't a phenomenon by an unknown entity with extraordinary technology that's just not supposed to exist. So then you can start with that. The frustration that I continually get when I hear these know-nothings get on TV arguing against all of this, and they immediately start with the stupidest objections, like, well, it's impossible for aliens to come here because they're too far away. You know, who's talking about that? All we should be dealing with is what we know is true. Start with empirical observation and take it from there. And then we can puzzle out the details. So anyway, this is my vote for top 15. You could come up with others that are equally good or maybe even a little bit better, but that's a good place to start. So the first real that's just a quick prologue to get that out of the way. There's been a long history of provocation and confrontation between the many militaries of the world and these objects. As I indicated, the open literature, some of the documents I just showed you, make this very, very clear that the United States, UK, all the major militaries of the world have handled this with very, very serious attention. There have been a long history of attempts to shoot down these unknown objects, as was mentioned earlier by Nick Pope in relation to Milton Torres. But that's one of many, many, many such cases, some of which were even more dramatic than that one. So whatever else is going on, there's trouble in paradise. I mean, in other words, any admission on the reality of this phenomenon is going to have to deal with the fact that we've been having some problems with these objects, whatever that is. Okay? Something's not right. This is just way too many for me to go through. All of this is in my next book, and there's the cover of my next book. I'm happy to say when it comes out, that's what it will look like. All of these, I think, are pretty nicely dealt with. So, in other words, some interesting military encounters with UFOs of the 1970s. Some of these are just phenomenal. The Iranian case is probably the most, I think, famous of them. I've been on a coast-to-coast radio a few times with George Norrie, and the last time I was on, George came out of the blue and said, "Well, Richard, what do you think is the strongest, best UFO case of all?" Caught me a little off guard, but I said, "Well, I think the Iranian case, actually, it's got fabulous documentation from the United States Defense Intelligence Agency. It's got a tremendous amount of personal testimony from the pilots, and one of the pilots involved. It even has confirmation by the United States satellite system known as the DSP satellites, the Defense Support Program, which really, I argue, are nothing more or less than UFO tracking systems in space. And they tracked at exactly the right coordinates at exactly the right time an unknown target directly over Tehran when all this happened. So it's really a great, solidly documented case. Anyway, moving along through the 1980s, same story. The Peruvian case actually happened in May 9th and 10th, 2 days in a row of 1980, in which a Peruvian pilot was ordered and did, in fact, fire upon a UFO. And the object just took off, gone. He had no opportunity to touch it. The next day, same event happened again. And in this case, the air-based commander said, don't fire, because the weapons were expensive and it had no effect, and he had to explain that. So actually, they didn't fire on it the next day. And on and on and on and on. I mean, the Rendlesham case, everyone probably knows about. Fantastic case, amazing case in 1986 over a large portion of Brazil, involving a lot of the Brazilian Air Force. I'll skip the details. You don't really need it at this point. You can read it in my new book when it comes out. Soviet encounters throughout. I mean, when the Soviet Union was in the process of cracking apart, 1989, 1990, 91, that was when, in that country, there was this little window of opportunity, so to speak, in which Soviet people started to talk about this. What you find in many nations is when you have a regime change, that's when insiders talk. When Franco died in Spain in 1975, immediately after there was a kind of a flurry of Spanish openness on a lot of things, of course, but including UFOs. When Mao died in China the following year, same thing happened. When going into the United States, our own crisis of Watergate wasn't quite a regime change, but it was close. It was a big crisis, and what did it result in? Passage of a Strength and Freedom of Information Act, particularly, which was instrumental then in bringing out a tremendous amount of fresh UFO data. And then, of course, in the case of the Soviet Union, where you have a lot of high-ranking ministers and generals saying, yes, absolutely, we have this problem all the time. In fact, Deputy Minister of Defense, Ivan Tretiak, at the time in 1990, said, that he knew of 40 cases offhand where Soviet jets encountered UFOs. Initially, he said they were ordered to try to shoot them down, but we lost too many pilots. They went down. And so the new order became to, chase but don't shoot, because there were too many deaths. So evade them. Leave them alone. And then the Soviet Colonel Boris Sokolov, who was in charge of a great portion of the Soviet UFO military investigation, said that there were thousands of Soviet cases during the 1980s. In the U.S., I can skip these. There's just more and more. It never stops. There's the thing that's amazing about this phenomenon is how dense it is, how frequently these jet interceptions actually do occur, and the fact that they get no media portrayal whatsoever. If they were to get the kind of portrayal that they warrant, I think it would absolutely easily dominate. It really would dominate the news. I think there's a great hunger everywhere I go for people in this topic. Typically, they just don't have any knowledge of it. And I think if they were presented with the sheer quantity of incredible, head-scratching UFO encounters, I think they'd be very interested. This one is a very well-known case, it's really just outside of Washington, D.C. in 2002. It's 50 years to the day after some dramatic encounters over D.C. in 1952. 2002, just outside D.C. in a little suburb of Waldorf, Maryland, a number of witnesses at 1:30 in the morning got out of their homes because they heard the rumbling of F-16 jets going over their houses. Many of them, about half a dozen or so, called in their local radio station and said, well, there's this blue object that they seem to be chasing. One of the witnesses I had the chance to speak to, Rennie Rogers, described it very clearly. He's a government worker. He comes out. He had worked the shift until midnight. He was just watching television. Came out and he saw the jets. And then he saw in this portion of the sky this object come down at an 80-degree angle and stopped there. A little while later, the jets turned around and chased after it. Had no chance to get this thing. It just went gone. Took off. It's an interesting case because although there's no FOI documentation on this to this day, there was a Washington Post article on it in which they quoted Air Force officials, so we know it happened. And the Air Force, and the Post did the standard he said, she said nonsense to throw cold water on this. So they interviewed Rennie, and then they had this Air Force talking head who said, well, it could have been any number of things. It doesn't say what they could have been. I'd like to know, post 9/11, what kinds of blue objects can outperform two F-16s, right near D.C., post-9/11 America? I think that's a little bit interesting. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Could have been any number of things. It doesn't say what they could be. The other interesting thing about that article was that an anonymous Air Force person told the media that they were tracking this thing on radar, and then it just blipped off the radar and was gone. So whatever. So it continues on, never stops. And then a little over a year ago, a famous case took place in Texas, the town of Stephenville. A bunch of people saw this immense object. One person described it, it was so big, it was described as a flying Walmart, which is the scariest of all things. When Walmarts fly, I'm gone, man. I'm out of here. Okay. But anyway, so it came over and then stopped, and then took off, and a bunch of F-16s were seen in pursuit. And in fact, we were able to get, I think we very loosely, wasn't me, Angela Joyner, local reporter, and some other people were able to obtain FAA radar data about that, and the last bit of information they were able to get confirmed from the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, was that this object was last seen going off in the direction of the Crawford Ranch, which was President Bush's retreat. It literally was going off in exactly that direction. And what we don't know is whether it continued over there, but it was going in that direction. So that's rather interesting, I should say. So a little bit of some of these confrontations. There's much, much more. There's really no need for me to go into a lot of detail for our purposes, except to say there's a great deal of documentation of military interest in these objects, many attempted interceptions, close encounters. There have been probable crash retrievals. One of the cases I mentioned previously, I didn't really discuss it on the list, was a crash in Bolivia in 1978, for example. It's a very interesting case. Whether it's an alien craft or not, I couldn't tell you, but it's strange, very strange. And as I'll mention in a moment, there was actually, I think, a good amount of research done, starting a little bit leaks and so on in the 50s and 60s, but then in the 70s taking off, a lot of insiders talking about crash retrievals of UFOs that have gone down, not just Roswell, many, many. And so if that's true, and I think it is, so you've got that whole aspect going on. So in other words, a silent Cold War. Think of it that way. And so openness on this topic is going to have to deal with this reality. And this, let me just interject here, is the one issue of discomfort that I have with the thesis that an announcement about UFOs will be of an invasion, will be a false flag operation. I mean, here's what I can certainly say on my own behalf, that any announcement that any government says on UFOs is going to be a lie. I will not ever believe it. And if Barack Obama tomorrow were to say we're being invaded by aliens, I would be very, very suspicious of anything he says. All right? But the fact is that there is a genuine history of confrontation, and indeed I would say hostility at some level between us and them. Okay. So any disclosure will have to answer, why are we chasing them? Fair question. So now we get into what I call the structure of secrecy, crash retrievals, and money. Any secret that's important is going to be a secret that's worth money. So let's go back in time. Pretend that you're Harry Truman in the late 1940s, whenever the president might have been informed that, yes, sir, we have recovered technology that does not appear to have been manufactured by human hands, let's just say. Okay. So what would you do? Well, I think in our first instinct would be, well, we have to tell the world this is important. We can't hide it from humanity. But you might not. You might not. Not in 1947, let's say, when you have the beginnings of a Cold War, however you want to interpret the justness of the American side of it, okay, it's really irrelevant. You're running this country, this enormous multinational corporation called the United States, and are you going to tell the world that you've recovered this exotic technology, when in fact you weren't even willing to share atomic technology with the world, which in 1947 was a very big issue. The United Nations was pounding at the door at the time saying, hey, atomic technology is so important, America. You need to share it and put it under United Nations control. America's answer was, no, thank you, because they didn't want to share it. Okay, so I think it's likely that they wouldn't want to share something as exotic as alien technology. So you keep it secret. You might organize a group of top people around you, various disciplines. You say, your job is to figure out how bad the panic will be. Your job is to figure out who these other beings are. Your job is to figure out what we can do with this technology and make money off of it. Right, all of this. And I think, and maybe, I'm just, this is pure speculation, the plan might not have been for secrecy forever. I don't really know what the original motivations might be. They might have just been, we need to review this in a couple of years and decide our plan. Right now, we're just going to keep this very quiet. So you start something like MJ-12, as it's often been called. I think that's probably the logical thing you would have done. But the problem with any secret, of course, is that it develops its own momentum and its own profitability. And this is exactly, I think, what happened. So what happens with all of this? Well, I think once you've got the secret, it becomes inevitable that it goes private, as I like to say. So in other words, you know, I've got this little alien artifact, and let's say I'm the army. Okay, so, well, sure, there are scientists working directly in the U.S. Army, and some of them are very, very brilliant. But really, if I want to do this right, I'm going to take this to General Electric or Lockheed or Boeing, because they have the R&D, they've got the scientists. I mean, they make stuff for me. That's their job. They're the best people at it. So at a certain point, this exotic technology will go in very, very compartmented ways to the various places where it needs to be studied. Maybe if you get lucky to replicate it, but more realistically, just to study it and find out what you can learn from
it. Let's see. Oh, sorry. They interject these advertisements. One second. Here we go.
And then, of course, it's a great little gig because when you retire from your position in the military, you go work for them as a senior vice president and make a fortune on all kinds of ground floor investment opportunities. But what it does is, to some extent, it means giving up some level of ownership, so to speak, of this exotic technology to the corporations. It makes perfect sense, okay? Particularly when your own government is dominated by those corporations. Particularly when all of the United States government was literally dominated by members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was and is a tool explicitly of industry and finance to set U.S. policy since, you know, the immediate aftermath of the First World War. Of course they're going to want to do that. And it helps with the secrecy. Because once it's outside of the formal government system, then, you know, government people can genuinely say, well, it's not part of, you know, I have nothing to do with this. None of our agencies have anything to do with this. And that would be true to a large extent. As I interjected earlier today, as Richard Helms, the CIA director, once said, the first rule in keeping secrets is nothing on paper. You keep things out of the formal system. It's done all the time. We have a series of statements, actually, by a former U.S. senator and a one-time presidential candidate who was nominated by the Republican Party in 1964 for president. He lost to LBJ Johnson. Barry Goldwater, who had a strong interest in this topic, was a very close friend of U.S. Air Force legend Curtis LeMay, and spoke on several occasions about how he was rebuffed in his attempts to gain access to the legendary Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where it was said many, many times alien bodies were stored there. Goldwater, in 1981, wrote a letter to a constituent, just said, this thing has gotten so highly classified, it's just impossible to get anything on it. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut, has spoken about this many, many times, actually starting 1997. You know, recently Mitchell very belatedly got some press last summer on his statements about this. Actually, though, started making statements in 1997, as far as I can trace, talking about, we're looking at likely reverse-engineered technology in the hands of the humans that are not under government control or any type of high-level control. Keeping in mind that if you're Edgar Mitchell, in fact, whether you even believe that he went to the moon or not, that's almost irrelevant because as an official moonwalking astronaut, really, who's not going to want to be your friend? Edgar Mitchell knows everyone that he needs to know at top levels of the national security community, some very, very high-level people indeed, who have spoken to him privately, and he's mentioned this to me and publicly, that there are groups that have in their possession alien technology and bodies. Now, even whether he's right or wrong is, I mean, that's important. But really, I've just wondered for years, where the hell has been the mainstream media? You've got this Apollo astronaut who's not senile, who has a PhD, very sharp guy, very nice guy. No one would listen to him. He finally got some press last summer, and then, of course, it just went into the black hole, as it always does, and gets forgotten. One of Mitchell's insights that he gained from his sources was that this whole thing has gone out of, it's in the hands of rogue groups. It's not under formal government control. And look, forget UFOs. Look at any other aspect of government, and we can all see it. I mean, we've gone through a kind of silent revolution in the last two decades. It's a transnational revolution. Looking at, in the U.S., the battle over NAFTA, 1992-93. World Bank, IMF. Things that have happened to facilitate the death of nations, which is really the era that we're living in. Who's in charge? Who's in charge? Is it the nation anymore? Is it the people? Are the people sovereign of their nations, really? Well, it's a great idea, and I'll believe that idea until the day I die, but is that really what's going on? Anyway, the UFO secrecy fits that whole pattern of privatization of power. So now let's, pretend again that we've got this alien artifact and we're studying it. So now how do you pay for the research? How do you really do all of it? Well, you've got to have secret money. I'm now convinced that the UFO secret is one of the foundational elements of the so-called black budget. I think that it's instrumental. I mean, I really wasn't in this place a number of years ago. It took time for me to kind of figure this out. But I think the UFO secret isn't the only foundation of the black budget, but I think it's really one of the linchpins of it. Because it's a secret that was so big and is so big, to fund it is a lot of money. If you want to create, let's say, secure underground facilities, all right? If you want to create the kind of security necessary to keep this. And by security, I don't mean just guys with guns, but I mean management of the press, management of the academic community. And don't think it doesn't happen. All right? There's some very good work, public mainstream work done on, for example, the CIA's manipulation of the American academic community. It's a very good book called Cloak and Dagger by a fellow named Robin Winks, all about the CIA and Yale University, which in fact is the, as pointing, mentioning to Ian, that's where Skull and Bones is based at, Yale, not Harvard, but nonetheless. Harvard is also a CIA, place, obviously. But in this particular study, Winks shows slam dunk, absolutely clear-cut case of how the CIA manages Yale. And they do it with so many schools. And so, for like Harvard, for many years, was the place of Donald Menzel, longtime UFO debunker, the most prominent debunker in the world during the 50s and 60s. Menzel was the chief astronomer at Harvard. Well, it was only after his death that we learned Menzel was at this level with the NSA and U.S. intelligence in general. Menzel was plugged into the max. Okay? So here's the function that the intelligence community fulfills within academia. You bring in the key players, and they manage the choke points. So when some little rinky-dink professor at some little community college wants to get, off on how the UFO conspiracy is so bad, then you get some big shot like Menzel to slap him down. That's how the whole system works. They don't really care what the little guy says because they can be managed. And it's the same with the media. During 1975, in the United States, there was an incredible wave of dramatic, scary, amazing airspace violations along the whole U.S. northern border and into Canada. It got local media coverage, didn't get a speck of national coverage. And that's because the story was choked off at the level of Reuters and Associated Press. It never made it. Got tremendous local coverage where it died. So you control the nodes, and you can control the whole big picture. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, I'm getting a little digressing here. Paying for the research means to fund it is expensive. And so you've got to get the money from sources that are not necessarily open. So part of it can be in classified expenditures through Congress, or undoubtedly through Parliament, but a lot of it, let's face it, isn't it much nicer to have unvouched money that you don't have to explain to people? Hence the importance of narcotics trafficking. All right, and if you've done any little bit of, tiny bit of research on the CIA, then you know that the agency has had a long-standing, up to their eyeballs, involvement in narco trafficking. And it's not just the CIA. You know, if you, any intelligence agency that wants to raise secret armies, rig elections, do all kinds of things that they're not supposed to do, means they need a lot of money. And so they'll deal with, I mean, drug trafficking is, I don't know, it's in the top five industries in the world. I mean, you got right up there with oil and cars and weapons, drugs, except that it's illegal, but don't think for an instant that just because it's illegal that no one wants that money. Everyone wants that money. So, in other words, however you fund this program, it involves a subversion of the formal political system. There's no way around it. Very good article on the black budget process by this gentleman, Bill Sweetman, who's he's not really a UFO guy, he's an aviation aerospace guy. Did a really good article about 10 years ago on what are known as special access programs, and these are the prototypical black budget programs. At the time, his estimate, there's almost no public literature that really investigates the black budget process. Sweetman did a pretty good job. His estimate at the time is that there were about 150 special access programs. And the real interesting thing about them, one is that he had no idea how they got all their money. But what he was able to determine is that there was little to no oversight, no oversight by Congress anyway. And they had their own sort of independent, unique classification system. So if I were the manager of one special access program, I would create my system, and I would say, you're in, you're out. You have 4 stars, doesn't matter, you're out. You, I grew up with, I know you, I trust you, you're in. And that's how that would work, according to what Sweetman learned. And the key thing was that in his analysis, they weren't dominated by Pentagon personnel. They were not dominated by U.S. military people. The special access programs were dominated by the contractors, by General Electric and Lockheed and Boeing and those guys. They were in charge. And that the DOD liaisons were basically, as he could say, gatekeepers for money, for funding. And that was basically it. So, again, not a UFO piece, but it's a good analysis on how some of this works. Catherine Austin Fitz, who I think qualifies in my book as an American hero, was a cabinet member on the George Bush Sr. administration. She was Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. Deeply corrupt. They all are. Catherine, though, is a financial whiz. That was her background. So she goes into HUD, and since she's number two at the agency, and since she's the finance maven there, she thinks, well, I'd like to look at the budget of HUD. And she said, she's told, sorry, ma'am, you're not authorized to see the budget. She's like, come again with that? So she knocks on enough doors after enough months, finally, just to shut her up. They wheel in. She describes this as very humorous. It would be humorous if it weren't so, horrible. Crate after crate, rolling in stacks of papers. I mean, no one can go through these. It would be really almost impossible. Here you go. She went through them. She said, God himself could not audit the United States government. He couldn't audit HUD. It's not possible. And her determination was that at least 85% of the U.S. federal budget is literally unauditable. She also determined, to her own satisfaction, the key importance played by drug trafficking, securities fraud, stock market fraud, in washing through the U.S. government. She's got a great article I considered a modern classic called What's Up with the Black Budget? Go Google it, read it, where she talks about missing trillions and trillions of dollars. This is during the 1990s, prior to 2001, in fact. So then, in other words, that's the end of my second section. True disclosure, we have to confront the illegal structure of our society and the massive theft that has sprung up to handle UFO secrecy. So now, what is this program about? Why the secrecy? Well, I think one of the things that they're working on is to try to make their own UFOs. I think that's a big part of the secrecy, so let me get into that a little bit. And this is not an actual photograph, please. I don't want to deceive you. it's a cool picture. So, of course, I've kept it in there. Back in the 1980s, I mean, this is not going back 25 years, an aviation aerospace writer, James Goodall, who wrote for many mainstream publications, started looking into Groom Lake, that is S4, Area 51. Before the world heard of Bob Lazar, James Goodall was investigating that whole area. And his contacts, his analysis led him to conclude that there were at least 8 black, that is, secret programs, flying out of Groom Lake, including a silent triangle. He asks one of his sources at Groom Lake, this is a non-commissioned officer with over like a decade of experience there, do flying saucers exist? The guy said, yes, absolutely, positively they exist. Following up, another source saying, we have things out there that are literally out of this world. This is 1985, 86. Better than Star Trek. So fill in the blanks, whatever that means. George Knapp is an investigative journalist. If you've listened to Coast to Coast, he's often a host on Coast. I happen to like George very, very much. George Knapp is the man who made Bob Lazar something of a household word. He was the guy who really did the initial interviews with Lazar in 1989, where Lazar said, yes, I worked at this place called S4, and I was there to study the propulsion system of a flying saucer that was not you, it was alien. Well, the thing about Knapp that's interesting is that he interviewed, actually, he said more than a dozen Area 51 insiders. In fact, he later said it was more than 20 insiders who strongly corroborated much of what Bob Lazar said about his experience at Area 51. In other words, a program designed to study and attempt to replicate alien flying saucers, put it that way. None of them, understandably, were willing to talk publicly. George described a few of these particular cases where he was cultivating certain witnesses, trying to get them to speak. Some of them came pretty close and then were threatened, literally on the day that interviews were being scheduled. This is a great clip you can look up on YouTube, Nellis UFO, or you can look up Nellis ARV for Alien Reproduction Vehicle, and you'll find this is a 2 or 3 minute clip. It was a video that was leaked to the American TV show Hard Copy in early 1995. It's been dated very definitively to have been filmed in November of 94. And it's also been definitively analyzed to have been taking place in Groom Lake in Nevada. And what it shows is this object coming out and doing amazing things, stopping, zigzagging, incredible accelerations, changes of speed, all within a 2 minute period of time. What's neat about it is that it's got informational readouts here, so you can check the altitude and its position and so on. So it allows for analysis to be done so that we know that this object is about 15 feet wide. Its range of speed was anywhere from 15 or 20 miles per hour up to 500 miles per hour within a 2 minute span of time. Made a right angle turn at about 140 miles per hour, about, I guess, 200 kilometers per hour. Pretty nifty in 1994. Not too bad. Now, my assumption is that that's something that we, putting that phrase loosely, very well probably made. I could be wrong, maybe it's alien, but my feeling is that's probably something that we've been testing. So another thing that the program is about, I think, is going out there. Why would the secret program be about going into space secretly? Well, it might if you become convinced that there are genuine anomalies on the moon or Mars. In that case, you might think, well, we need to investigate this, but we can't really alert the public because that would blow the whole deal. So we're going to have to create a black space program and just go with some of the technology that we've been developing. I think that's probably the case. Would you have secret transportation to the moon or Mars related to the anomalies there? Or anomalies in Earth orbit, of which there are many and seemingly unending. This gentleman, of course, I think is well known to most residents of the UK, Gary McKinnon. One of the things that...
Did you guys just hear what he said? He said, you may have many forms of alternate transportation within Earth's orbit. That's the ISS. He's saying it without saying it. His work is brilliant. There's 20 minutes more here. Let's listen. I have to cover my mouth not to squeal every time he says something incredible, which is every couple of minutes. There's no way to cover Richard Dolan's body of work. I could spend years studying his work, and I have. Here we go.
What has fascinated me about the Gary McKinnon case is how, in the last two or three, four years, any mention of Gary McKinnon, at least in the States, almost never mentions the UFO connection. It's almost completely forgotten. And when he first got arrested, that was the big thing. You know, guy hacking into a U.S. Space Command site looking for UFOs. Okay. But now he's just described as the world's greatest military hacker. As like this terrorist. Okay? When in fact, the guy was looking for UFO evidence. And then he gets arrested. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, no one in the media is asking the obvious question, which this guy says that he found a list of officer names under the heading of non-terrestrial officers. Well, that's rather interesting. Okay? And is it just a load of BS? Well, if so, then why is the United States intent on imprisoning him for the rest of his life? Right? No one asks these questions in the mainstream. It's just completely gone. I think anyone who's spoken to Gary McKinnon, you listen to him speak, you listen to his radio, his interviews, and he's an honest guy. He's just a guy who got screwed, who was trying to find some information out. Was he wrong to do so? Well, yes, legally he was wrong to do so. But I think in the larger picture, it's not hard to see that he's a nice guy. I don't think he was trying to destroy the United States. But anyway, so they go after him. And of course, his life has been really, so far, destroyed. Let us hope that it doesn't turn out the way it may look. So anyway, just backing up to Gary McKinnon. So I think we can class him in the case of providing evidence that there's something in Earth orbit. There's something in space that's going on that's not supposed to be there. This man, who sadly passed away a little over a year and a half ago, Jeff Challender. I had the pleasure to meet Jeff a couple of times, and we really liked each other. And then he died, and I was just absolutely shocked and saddened by it. But his website is still up. It's projectprove.com. I would urge you to go check it out. And what Jeff did, he had a severe disability, and he had a very difficult time walking. So he spent a lot of time in home, but he was a space fanatic. And he spent all of his time downloading NASA footage, and then footage also from European space missions, Russian and at the end Chinese video. And it's all on his site of these real strange, inexplicable things going on in Earth orbit. So I think at the very least what you could say is that Jeff has gathered together a very strong bit of evidence that there are things happening in Earth orbit that are not, again, not supposed to be happening. So, I mean, whether those are made by us or not by us, what you can say is that these anomalies in Earth orbit would be sufficient evidence to motivate a secret space program, right? So either we made them, which would prove we have a secret space program, or if we didn't make them, that would be strong evidence that we would want to have a secret space program to investigate it. So any disclosure will have to deal with that. Has the covert world evolved into what I'm now calling, in my new book, a breakaway civilization? It's a real question to ask. I mean, look, throughout most of human history, we've had different civilizations existing at the same time. Go back 500 years, Europe and China, living with very, very different presuppositions about the way the world is, levels of technology, right? Even the old Cold War, the Western scientific community and the Soviet Eastern scientific community did not always share their data. Heck, the Soviets believed in the BS of Trofim Lysenko, if you know the history of biology, right up into the 1960s, a load of crap. So, in other words, there's a history of a lack of unity in our own, scientific institutions globally. So, think about what the secret world could do with basically an infinite amount of money to play with, total secrecy and security to research what they want. And let's say with this little alien artifact, they have a couple of good eureka moments. The real question is, would they truly share every one of those with the rest of the world? I think you might not. I don't know. I mean, if you've got a mission that's partly off-world or a mission that deals with these other guys, whoever they are, you really might want to withhold some of your best technology solely for that. When the United States bombed Libya in 1986, they didn't use the stealth fighter, even though it was operational at the time. They used a bunch of F-111s. Why? Well, because the stealth fighter was considered too important to risk even on a mission like that to expose it. All right, and that's just a simple example of how your leading technology would be withheld from important missions. And I think it's really not that difficult to see that within what we can call the black world, what happens with science is it goes exponentially. So one breakthrough leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And I can personally just easily see a situation where such amount of breakthroughs become cumulative to the effect, to the extent that they effectively put that world into the realm of being a different civilization with different fundamental suppositions of what they think are true and different technologies that are vastly beyond what we deal with. I've 10 minutes. I'm about 30, 40% through. So that's typical for me. So let's just blow through this. That's okay. So then the fourth section is, well, who are these aliens? What are they up to? What's up with the aliens? Here's a few things we can know about them. If you want to believe in abduction research, which, why not? They're telepathic. They can get into your head. They can control your emotions. They can manage your memory. They have a mastery over space-time. I mean, keep in mind that our understanding of space-time is not objective. It's based on our brains. Okay? Space and time are a fabric. You know all this. They've figured it out somehow. They can play games with time and space. They don't seem to have emotions like we do. Do they look like us? Maybe some of them do. If I were an alien, I'd want to grow or breed my own human population. I'll get into that a little bit more. Are they truthful? Even if they're good guys, they probably aren't truthful. If you were to go back 1,000 years in time and wander around medieval Europe, you might not want to tell those people where you're from either. You might have a difficult time explaining to them what you're all around. And I think that there's more than one group involved with diverse agendas operating by stealth. I wanted to get into the circles. I'm fascinated by the circles, as anyone with a brain should be. I bring up the circles here only to point out, look how perfect that is. That was from a year ago. One of the most amazing ones.
He's talking about the crap.
That expresses the value of pi to the 10th decimal. We'll skip the details. It's crap. Here's my little bit of hope. If they're doing the circles, then I hold out hope for some of them, because I think what they're trying to do is to trigger maybe a secret Leonardo da Vinci wandering around, doing all of this. But then you get the other side. Are they taking us? If so, why? Any kind of exopolitics is going to have to deal with the abduction issue in an honest way. What the hell is going on with that? I'm going to have to skip this section, except to say that Bud Hopkins' last book, I think it's a really pretty good book, deals with not your standard ETs, but cases of ETs that look kind of human, but they don't act human. Interesting book. He considered them transgenic beings, that is, cross-species. Dealing with them. So how do we deal with them? They have extreme intelligence and psychic ability. How do you deal with someone like that? I mean, how do you personally deal with someone like that? Not as equals, probably. Seems to me that in our history with them, we've dealt with them on their terms, not ours, for the most part. Why are we interesting to them? Because we're reinventing who we are. 100 years ago, we had horses pulling carts. That's a sketch by Van Gogh. Horses pulling carts. Now we're in an era where we are maybe... If you think UFOs are kind of whack, you should read some good books on the future of artificial intelligence. And that's pretty far out, where many AI experts are very, very matter of fact about, you know, the likelihood that in less than 20 years your computer will be talking to you, telling you it's a conscious sentient being, and you'll probably accept those claims because it sure is going to seem like it. Except it'll also be able to do a quadrillion number of calculations per second and pull any bit of data off the internet like that. So it'll be like you or me, but on a really good day, nonstop. Are they going to say, oh, humanity, yeah, let's get that. Or, you know, do a Matrix or a Terminator, let's hope not. Who knows? Read up, get into this. There's some fascinating issues going on. Quantum computing, I don't even know what that is, to be honest with you, except that that's going to be as revolutionary as, or more than, say, the Gutenberg printing press. The one caveat, so in other words, within 20 years, we're going to be like a completely different species. Very, very possibly. Unless we fall off our little tightrope, because we're perched very high, and we can fall. And if we fall, that is if we have an infrastructure meltdown, then maybe all bets are off. Unless, of course, the guys organizing the Club of Rome, the Bilderbergs, have got their plan to save the top 1 million people. I wouldn't rule that out in the least. But what it does mean is that we are probably the humanity that is the greatest show in this quadrant of the galaxy. I guarantee you, any other intelligences that are watching this area are saying, humanity, wow, check it out. Check out the show. Could we be a problem for them? I think yes. I think we could. We could be a real pain in the pain in the ass to them, frankly, because of the rapidity with which we have changed who we are. Again, progress doesn't just go in a straight line. It goes by jumps. And if we get to the point where we have hyper-advanced artificially intelligent machines merging with humans, hey, you know what? That might get their attention. So what would they might want to do? They might want to manage our society. I would. You might want to, they would be idiots not to try to influence us in some ways. I'm not saying that's definitely the case, but I am saying that it's a logical scenario to look at. Okay, so I've got to wrap this up here. So here's some exopolitical problems. What if we learn that some of these aliens look just like us and they live with us? It sounds crazy. What if it's true?
What if it's true?
And, you know, presumably they wouldn't be sweeping the floors. So presumably they'd be doing things that matter. And what if that's the case? You know, what if you pull out Tony Blair's eyes and you see that he's an actual reptilian? Yikes! What if there are factions that don't all get along? What if there was a deal, as many people have alleged, with them? You know, there's a lot of these questions. So what if they created us? What if? Well, I don't have the answer to every one of these, but they would be certainly major exopolitical issues that would have to be dealt with, and that would be very divisive, to say nothing else. I mean, this would really cause massive political upheaval, right? Wouldn't it? And then how do you undo a lie like this? How do you just say, yeah, it looks like they're here? Now you have to explain all of this, some of this stuff that I've just been talking about. The stresses that would be involved, I'm going to have to skip past a lot of this. Will there be armed revolt, riots, financial disruption? You bet. I mean, if they make a better version of our steel or petroleum or, any other technologies, that could be really a problem, at least in the short term. Sure, it'd be great in the long term. What about free energy? Is free energy really our salvation? Well, it sounds like it'd be pretty cool. You could heat your home forever for free. But what if also with this free energy you could make a really nice bomb that'll blow up the Pacific Ocean? I mean, really, what if? There might be a real problem with that. Just saying. Will the human power structure survive an actual disclosure unless it forces them to clamp down immediately into a full-blown totalitarian global police state? Maybe. It's impossible, but it's inevitable. The fact is, you can't stop time. We can't. Maybe they can. How well prepared are we? I would say not very. Do our political institutions or our universities prepare us? I think, again, not really. What do we expect these aliens to do? They want us, we're going to have them save us, make us better? What I try to remind myself is ultimately we have to live with ourselves. And in other words, to deal with this other reality, ultimately
means that we ourselves have to understand who and what we are. We're born into this world alone. We go out alone. We're going to have to deal with them in some way. So, in other words, not to sound too new agey here, but it really will truly require a raising of our consciousness if we're going to be any use in this new era when this does come out. It's going to come out. You can't stop it. It's like a tidal wave. I don't know the specifics of how it's going to happen, but it's going to happen. It will be impossible to stop. So we're going to need a development to get us at the level where we're going to be ready. We're probably never going to be ready, realistically, until it happens. Who's ever ready to have their first child? No one's ready for that. And then it happens, and boom, you have to deal with it. So, you know, it's going to happen. We're just going to have it forced on us. People are going to be running around in circles, pulling their hair out, and then they'll have to deal, hopefully, and that'll be that. We're living in a revolutionary era, more revolutionary than anything I think any of us can really imagine in the history of our species. It's happening now. I mean, think about how incredible that is. We're all living in it. We're living in the transformation of human civilization, maybe the falling off the tightrope, maybe getting to the other side. Either way, it's a wild ride. My feeling is that this unstable period leads inevitably to political and financial instability, which we're seeing. But that in itself will lead, I think, to an opening in this topic. In a period of turmoil, stuff happens. And I think something like this can break. I keep wondering, is the media's sea change? I track from late 06. I think what changed it, I think, was the O'Hare incident. It was a UFO over O'Hare International Airport in November of 06. When that got out, that was not ridiculed. I mean, it was a little bit, but a lot, in large measure, it wasn't. And all through 2007-08, we saw a very different treatment of this. Not really, I mean, the media is not treating it the way it really should be, but differently. The amount of reportage has gone dramatically up, and of a quality that's very different than pre-2006. Something may be going on. It may not be fun, but then again, it's going to happen. I just want to close by saying that the new book that I've just completed, UFOs and the National Security State, truly will be available within 30 days. I've been saying this, you know, for like a million years now, but it will be done. It's a little more than 600 pages. It's my attempt to analyze the UFO history phenomenon from the early 70s to the end of the Cold War. Let's call it the pivotal volume in a three-volume history that I'm doing. I think it's starting to turn into the war and peace of UFOs, but that's okay. So it will be available. You can go to my website, keyholepublishing.com, and look for an announcement. You can hopefully be able to get it. I do have a couple of DVDs out there on the table. Not many, but I brought a few of some other presentations that I've given, and I would certainly encourage you to come to my table and chat. I'd be happy to talk with you. Thank you so much for having me here. Thank you.
Richard Dolan, everybody. Wow. So when we're looking at the body of exopolitics, we can look at Dr. Robert Wood and Ryan Wood's work at majesticdocuments.com, Linda Moulton Howe at earthfiles.com, Stanton Friedman's extensive work since the 70s, Grant Cameron, who's the cousin of David Cameron, and his work about the UFO politics of the United States president. And then you can look at people like Dr. Stephen Greer and Stephen Bassett. And then when you put all those guys together and add Richard Dolan, for me, that's the meat of it, all of it. The others are researchers and witnesses. I guess I can't leave out Donald Schmidt. He's brought a lot to light as well. Anyways, Richard Dolan's take on things, for me, when I hear the other ones speak, I get it right away. I know what they're saying. It's fascinating. It's fabulous. It's wonderful. When I hear Richard Dolan, I say to myself, oh, that was only an hour and 9 minutes. I need to hear that again. And I told him when I met him, I've watched his videos over and again because he's truly educating us on really what's happening. And there's so much woven into his work. He's really a masterful speaker because he shares with us things that haven't been shared, but he says it without saying it. Very cool. What would I like to share to wrap up? Let's see. So much is happening so quickly that I'm overwhelmed and I can barely keep up with it. I have about 300 emails. I need to go back and answer emails. I'm working on that. I'm starting to get a little bit nervous because I'll be traveling so much in April and there's so many details to look at. I'm excited too. For me, if you can feel the pulse of it, can you not feel disclosure coming inevitably right now in front of our eyes? Can you imagine what it'll be like for those 5 days to hear these masters speak on exopolitics? So remember, go to citizenshearing.org. It's $3.80 for the whole week. Such a bargain. Go buy your free $3.80 pass and watch it live stream. Please go sign the petition. I know we can get 100,000 signatures. I've never felt that way before, but I feel that way about this one. This is a dare. This petition that I put out is a dare to the media to report on these things. The reason I chose the NSA astronauts issue that landed on the moon in 1961 is because so many people won't believe it. And it's a little bit sensationalism. And so it's not really combative because people will laugh it off. And like he said, they'll slap it down. They'll say it's nonsense and that I'm hooky. So that's why I think we can get this one through. So please put it out there, everybody. I think maybe now that it's almost 2 hours gone, I should probably say goodbye. Please join me here again tomorrow, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Namaste.